In this episode, I chair a Take That roundtable on the album Beautiful World. Then David Snape is my guest in The Empty Compartment. That's all to come on the 90s and Noughties UK podcast, a podcast on UK pop culture from the 90s and 2000s. This is Jamie Dyer saying welcome to the show. And if you'd like to get in contact, you can tweet us 90s Noughties UK on Twitter. You can email 90sandnoughties@gmail.com. That's 90sandnoughties@gmail.com. Or you can just go to the Facebook page, 90s and Noughties UK. So here we are on the 90s and Noughties UK podcast. And just before we get into the main content of this week's podcast, I'd like to say thank you once again for the support that I have received via social media and emails. It's so great to see so much enthusiasm for the show in particular and the era in which we cover here. Also, I should point out that I'm sure that everybody is aware, for those in the UK, it has been extremely hot in the past week. And I tell you this because if you're listening far on in the future and you're thinking, well, that's a bit unprofessional, I can hear fans in the background, it's because it is so hot that literally if I didn't have a fan going, it would be quite hard to function and do the show to the best of my ability. And I'm sure there are loads of people in the same situation at the moment. So yeah, please do keep that in mind when you're listening to the show, although elements of it have been recorded at different times, because that is how I do it. I record it at different times, put it all together. It's this week's show. Great. So what have we got coming up on this week's show? Well, later I'm joined by radio presenter extraordinaire David Snape for the another edition of the Empty Compartments, the section of our show where we have three questions, one guest, and hopefully a really random time. That's to come a little bit later, but first this. Before we get on to this week's roundtable, which this week is focused on Take That and their comeback album, Beautiful World, I now present to you Postbag, which is a regular feature that we've been doing here on the podcast, where I ask you questions and you answer them, basically. And I'm always looking for people to participate, and I'll give you most of the details in just a moment. So, without further ado, before this week's roundtable, I present to you this week's edition of Postbag. So it's the post bag where we put out a message on social media asking a specific question and then you reply to us with your answer. So this week's question was, tell us your first memory of Take That and your favourite song by them. That's the question that we put to you on social media. And sadly, there weren't too many replies this week, as sometimes happens. But Rachel got in contact and she says, mine, she says, is watching Gary Barlow sing Power of Love in 1985. Wow, so that's pre Take That there, Rachel. That's very impressive. That must have been a pub gig or at least something along those lines. Please do get in contact and let us know, Rachel. I'd love to know. And so that's the end of the postbag feature for this week. And if you'd like to get involved in a future edition, then please do keep an eye on the social media, because we normally post the question early in the week, ready for the next episode. Right, let's move on now, shall we, to this week's roundtable, which, surprise, surprise, concerns Take That. This is another roundtable for the 90s and Noughties podcast, where I take a group of fans of a specific band or artist and chat about a certain album, single, or just any element of that particular band. And so today it's the turn of Take That, and I've gathered together a group of fans to discuss Beautiful World, which was a comeback album after 10 years out of the spotlight. Right, so thank you very much, Amy, Rachel, and Rachel. We've got two Rachels here. Amy, start us off. How did you get into Take That?
So basically, I was born in 87, so I was only two when Take That got together. But my sister, she's 7 years older than me, and we shared a bedroom for many, many years. So basically, her love for them, you know, kind of rubbed off on me. And by the time they broke up, I was absolutely head over heels in love as a nine-year-old, in love with Mark Owen. And it just never left me.
Well, I've been with Take That since the beginning, so 89, so a long time. I've never seen them live, though, because of reasons. I've got problems with mental health, so that's why I haven't seen them live. And my favourite is Mr. Gary Barlow.
So I was almost the beginning. So I got a television for Christmas. Must have been the back end of 89. Black and white television, you know, as you do, came with a set of rules of what you could and couldn't watch in your bedroom at night, and what time curfew was. And one night I was doing as I regularly did and breaking said curfew and stumbled on Hitman and Her. And that just happened to be the night that Take That were on it. I don't know, something just sort of clicked from that point on. You know, they were everywhere. I sort of remember getting up the following day, and then there was a little bit on the local radio, and then it just kind of spiraled, and it seemed to be more and more and more. And yeah, you know, like Amy said, by the time they split up, I was absolutely devastated. I was at college by that point, pretending to be super cool, pretending not to like Take That, as you do. I remember going home and absolutely sobbing my heart out. I still have all of the newspapers from that day. I can't bear to part with them. Thank God I have an understanding husband. They're all in a box in the spare room, and that's where they'll stay because they're just like in pristine condition.
Getting emotional.
The first time I kind of experienced Take That as a band, obviously you're always familiar with the music. I'm slightly late to the party. It was during that sort of 2006-07 period where they were suddenly back in the spotlight again. A member of my family bought me the Beautiful World album, and I sat and listened to this thing, and of course I was familiar with the old songs, but it really spoke to me. I was just about to go to college at that point, or I was certainly in my first year of college, so it was like a new beginning in the same way that that album was a new beginning. And even now, you know, I get fantastic memories of those years because of that music, and it really speaks for the time. So what do we think in general about that album? Is it like, do we think it's like a triumphant return to form? In you know, I realize I've just spewed my heart out about it, but what do we think of it?
No, I think it is. I think it was the long-awaited album that the original That Is, I don't think any of us ever imagined we would see. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I don't think any of us ever thought that we would see them back in the studio, let alone see new music. So to have Beautiful World, you know, and have these new songs, it meant so much. It literally did mean the whole world to us at that point. It was kind of like, we were all sort of growing up a bit then and supposed to be getting older, and suddenly there was this ray of hope that actually we could cling to our youth, and we didn't need to be quite as responsible just yet. And I think that was the thing that really drew me in. I think I will say this though, I think I think in recent years, I think Beautiful World is a fantastic album. You know, let's not forget it gave us, not only did it give us Shine, not only did it give us, you know, I'd Wait for Life, classic Barlow, you know, you can't have an album without a Barlow ballad. But the deluxe edition gave us Rule the World as well. These are songs that Take That sing all the time now, but we sort of tend to almost forget where they come from, forget their origin. And I think it, because some of the later albums or the more recent albums are talked about more and have had potentially a more visual impact, I do think we tend to sort of almost forget Beautiful World a little bit, which is a bit of a shame, really.
Don't forget about the song that brought him back after all those years.
Oh, you know? Yeah, Patience. How could I forget Patience?
Yeah, it was a perfect comeback.
For me, I obviously was very young the first time, so I never got to see them or anything. But like when I started secondary school, Westlife had just come on the scene, you know, so everyone was like, oh, Westlife and everything. And I never, ever lost my love for them. I know. I'm being from Dublin as well, like, you know, so, but I always thought in the back of my head, no, that this isn't it for Take That. Like, I'm not letting go. And with Beautiful World, it was the first time that I ever, you know, walked into a music shop to buy a Take That album in real time. And I never thought that would happen. I thought, you know, when you listen to the Beatles and you're like, oh, I wish I could have been there. I used to listen to Take That like that because I never thought that they would ever get back together. And I never thought I'd see them live. So, and I was 19 when that happened. So I was just like, yes, bring it on. Let's go.
We've talked about the singles on that album, the likes of Patience and Shine. And I always thought I'd Wait for Life was quite a poor single. I don't think it felt a bit disappointing after the first ones.
I know what you
Very
mean.
Sad.
I think every album needs a Barlow ballad. And that, for me, that is Beautiful World's Barlow ballad. And nobody does ballads like Barlow. I don't care who they are or what. And I've got quite an eclectic taste in music. I don't mind admitting it. There is nobody on this planet can do a ballad as well as Barlow can. I don't know why. I don't know what it is about him. But, you know, let's face it, he's been doing it long enough, hasn't he? What was he, 15 when he wrote A Million Love Songs or something?
Yeah. Long time. I love Beautiful World, though. I love Beautiful World. Like the song itself, like, yeah. Oh my God. And just see when they done it, they done like a little Apache on the tree tour and Howard was singing Beautiful World with the bongos. Oh, the hairs on the back of my neck just stood up. Amazing.
See, I really like Wooden Boat.
Love Wooden Boat, yeah.
I absolutely adore that.
Wooden Boat. Yeah, exactly. I think it's so underrated and I think Jason's voice is amazing. Isn't it such a shame we didn't get to hear more of it?
So angelic. He's a beautiful voice. I remember Nigel Martin Smith used to say, oh, you know, yeah, Jason's mic was turned off in the old days. I don't believe that for a second. Jason has a lovely voice.
Jason don't like being in the spotlight. That's why he doesn't sing much.
Yeah, maybe.
But then from Beautiful World onwards, I liked his contributions to to the albums. When he got given a lead vocal, you know, they were the ones that stood out.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Beautiful World did, isn't it? It gave them all the chance to shine, quite literally in Mark's case. You know what I mean? It finally gave them a chance. Up until that point, it was really only Barlow with the occasional bit of Robbie, wasn't it? And like now, since then, they've all had a chance. They all get a chance to sort of experiment and to do new tunes. And I think it was... It was more than a comeback album. It was a turning point for them in their relationship and their career. I think if they'd have existed with Gary just singing lead vocals, having lost Robbie, then losing Jason, I don't think they would have carried on as long as they had, because I don't think they would have had the variety and the depth to keep everybody interested as long as they have.
I completely agree. 100%.
Yeah. Well, I actually like Mancunian Way as a track, to be fair, which is Howard's track.
Good.
Yeah, I was always freaked out by the child at the end.
That's his child.
I think that's his.
Is that really? That was.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That wasn't planned. She came into the studio one day and he was singing that song, and he was like, do you want to have a go with Grace? And she sat up on his lap and she sang it, and they left it in.
You see, that's what I was going to say. There was a rumor that it was Grace, wasn't there? But I never knew whether that was true or not, or whether it was just a rumor.
No, it's Stephanie Horse. True. She's on the thing. Yeah.
There you go, Jamie. You learn something new every day.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So did anyone see them live at this point?
Yes. I've been to every single tour live. From.
And what was it like?
It was amazing. Although I missed my mum's birthday. My mum's birthday is the 23rd of December. And I was lucky enough to be in Manchester on the 23rd of December. So there's never been a tour like it for me. I mean, it's not my favourite tour, not by a long shot, but to see the guys having so much fun, being so relaxed just ahead of Christmas. They came on in Santa hats. Yeah. They sang, I think it was, what was it? I think they did Silent Night. Yeah. So that was it. They did Silent Night before, I think it was Pray. It was either Pray or Sure. And then they did, and I'll never forget this, it was amazing. They got a trumpet for Howard and he played Jingle Bells on like a central stage. And he played Jingle Bells while obviously the rest of the guys and the whole audience just sang Jingle Bells. It was the most surreal experience ever, but wonderful at the same time. So yeah, that's my little wonderful, beautiful world memory.
That's crazy. That's mad. They didn't actually play Dublin for a Beautiful World. We had to, me and my sister had to drive all the way up to Belfast. And obviously there was no Google Maps or nothing. So we kind of just were looking at signs, but we got there anyway. But yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And then we drove all the way home. I think we got home at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I'll never forget it. It was brilliant.
Rachel C, you say you've seen nearly every tour, lots of tours. Do you have a particular favourite of the ones that you've seen?
So up until this year, it was always Circus. Mm-hmm. Always Circus. The visual spectacle, the music, the camaraderie. It was the first time I'd been at the front as well for Circus Tour. So I had so many amazing memories. And then obviously, sorry, not this year, last year, Odyssey, Greatest Hits Tour. The first time I got to take my husband, and I took him twice. So we went to Sheffield. He was supposed to go with me on the very first reunion tour. You know, the, what did they call it? The Ultimate Tour, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
But he got a better offer. He got an offer to go away. So he went to Canada and I went originally for one day. I think it was to Manchester. Yeah, it was to Manchester. And then booked tickets to go to Milton Keynes the following weekend. And he got back and said, how was Take That? And I said, oh, it was fantastic. I've been twice. And he was like, hang on, you only have tickets for one. And I've been twice there. And I think sort of that was the turning point, because I've been to every tour since that reunion tour at least twice, if not three times, or in the case of Circus, four times. And seen, I make a point of always seeing the support acts as well, so that they get the same amount of support as what the boys do, because I think that's only fair, really. They're putting in as much effort, and sometimes it's harder because people are filtering in and they talk all the way through, so it is harder. But Odyssey was different. It was all of the greatest hits. It was everything I grew up with. It was a fantastic atmosphere, and yeah, you know, it was. I met some amazing people on the Odyssey tour as well finally getting to introduce my husband, who is now a convert. It's not taken me very long at all. I mean, you know, we've only been together for 16 years. Yeah, so Odyssey is definitely my favourite now, but very closely followed by Circus, I think.
Same. Yeah. Literally exactly the same. It was always Circus. Yeah. And then I went to Odyssey last year and I was trembling walking out of there. It was like, it just didn't, you didn't get a break. It just kept going and going. There was literally, I was like, when are they going to stop and take a break? Like, but I remember, as I said to Jamie earlier on, I missed Progress because I went traveling to Australia. So I know I was only supposed to go for a month and I stayed for like 3.5 years.
Oh my God. I'm not jealous at all.
I know. So I missed Progress. I camped out all night for Progress tickets and my sister went. But I went, I seen the Ultimate Tour twice like that in a week and a half. I seen it twice in Dublin. And they actually played Dublin, and then they went to the UK, done loads of gigs, and then they added another Dublin D in the RDS. Yeah. So I got tickets for that as well. And then after three, I was sitting with my friend Tina one night, and we were having a few drinks, and we accidentally booked tickets to see them in Amsterdam.
Did Amsterdam.
We did it. And we literally flew out on the Friday. Friday morning, and we went to see them the Friday night, and we flew back Saturday morning. So
well done. What was Amsterdam like?
I didn't see it. I don't know.
I literally saw the gig.
The airport was lovely, and the hotel was lovely, and the Ziggo Dome was lovely. And then we were home. So we didn't even get time to go into the city, but it was the most amazing 23 hours I'll ever experience. And we were right on the balcony, and we had like a big Ireland flag, and we had like a little comment written on it and everything. And it was unreal. Unreal. Aww. But I missed Progress. But yeah, no, Odyssey was amazing as well. They're all brilliant.
We'll go back to Beautiful World after that, because that, you know, obviously that's the subject of this particular round table in focus, but it's always great to hear live experiences. I unfortunately have not seen them live. And it sounds like I'm really missing out.
You absolutely are. And I understand, Rachel, why you can't go. But I mean, if there is any way at all, even if I have to go and make that happen.
It's not a case of I need to go now after all this.
Definitely. Because there's something about seeing them live that you can be a casual fan and a casual admirer of their music, and you go and see them live, and it just totally gets under your skin, and it sucks you in. There's nobody else like it in the business. The showmanship, so many people have since tried to copy what Take That do. And I think, you know, if you look back through the tours, you will see that they are the creators of this kind of very theatrical experience that we all love so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, what we have to remember is when Take That came back, they pretty much inspired every other 90s and 80s band going to revive themselves.
It was like a domino effect, wasn't it? Take That came back, and then all of a sudden everyone was crawling out from under rocks, like, where are they coming from, all these bands?
But at the same time, all the press were going, oh, they're doing a Take That.
Yeah. But I mean, the press have been pretty damning, shall we say, of Take That for a very long time. So I always find it quite hypocritical almost when they're saying, you know, people like they were saying back then, you know, oh yeah, they're doing a Take That. And if somebody does a tour that's quite similar to Take That, oh, they've been inspired by Take That, they've copied off Take That, you know. And then there'll be an article the following week that says, you know, how terrible Take That are. And you just think, you can't have it both ways.
They did say that about the Odyssey tour. They said that was their worst one ever. In the press.
Never believe a journalist. Never believe a journalist.
Best.
As they say, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, also that comeback kind of allowed people to rediscover or even discover Gary Barlow.
Yeah.
Because before then, he'd sort of been pushed to the background.
Yeah, he'd had a pretty tough time for a long time, hadn't he?
Spiraled really badly after they broke up. Well, I think when he thought he was going to make it in America. He didn't make it in America. He was still writing like songs for people and stuff. But yeah, after the kids were born,
he did have a hard time because of Robbie being in the spotlight rather than him.
Absolutely. And Robbie's music was doing better than his music in the charts, and the newspapers just wouldn't let it go.
I mean, I personally liked his solo material, but I don't think it really, like, in the public's imagination, quite sparked the same amount as Robbie.
I don't think he was in the right place, personally or musically, at that point. I think when you listen to what Gary was putting out and you listen to what was popular in the wider sort of music industry at that point, they felt very at odds with one another, and the charts weren't like they are now. They weren't based on downloads. There wasn't the variety. You couldn't have an old hit. It was all based on record sales. And I think I said at the beginning of this podcast that I was at college when they split up. So I was in that group of, it was no longer cool to like Take That, even though I still like Take That. And on the day that they split up, I remember being devastated. And like I say, I bought all of those newspapers. My friends knew that I was devastated. But at the same time, there was still this overarching air of coolness. I had to like Oasis.
You're not one of these ones that rung the line, are you?
No, but you know what I mean? It's, you don't consciously do it. But when you're that age, you just sort of fall into a line, and not a line, you fall into sort of a habit, don't you? So everyone around you is listening to. So in my case, everybody was listening to Oasis. And then that meant that they discovered all of these really cool artists again. So there was the likes of Pink Floyd and David Bowie. And that was the sort of thing that everybody was listening to. And I think if you think about Take That and think about what Gary was producing at that point, we're talking about the late 90s here, they were completely at odds with one another. And I think one of the reasons that Robbie did so, so well is because of his alliance with Oasis in those early days. In the days after he left Take That, he formed that really cool alliance that meant that it was okay to like him. And actually, and even now, I think if you look at some of the fan rivalry, I don't think there's actually a legitimate rivalry there. I think it still goes back to those almost those tribal lines that were drawn in the sand in the 90s of whether it was cool to admit you like Take That or whether you had to like Oasis and therefore only like Robbie. So I think once Gary, in a way, I know he had a tough time, but I think taking himself out of the limelight, doing what he did and going through those tough times has helped him come back better and stronger. It's given him more experiences to write about. He can write about them in a much stronger way. He's always been a phenomenal writer. But I think the stuff that he writes now is far superior to anything he's written before. You know, and you think about as well his personality. He no longer takes himself as seriously as he did. He was... Back in the day, he was the sensible one in the group. He was the one that had to pull everything together. He was the guy that, and in a way, that was one of the reasons why a lot of us younger girls didn't like him, because he was sensible, dad-like.
Yeah.
But, you know, now that's changed, hasn't it?
He was a bad boy. So everybody likes a bad boy.
Well, yeah, there is that as well. But I don't think he was probably as good as we all think he was, you know.
No, I doubt. I don't think he was, to be fair.
No, and then nobody else swore anyway. I wouldn't imagine. Jamie, that's where he met his wife. You know, she was one of the dancers and nobody else tour. Together, I wouldn't say he was very good on that tour at all.
No.
Yes, I think I did know that. I did know that. Yeah, so to wrap up here, somewhat, the Beautiful World album that we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, do we think it's like the definitive Take That album, or are there better ones in the catalogue?
I think there are different ones. That's my take on it. I think if you look at every Take That album brings something new to the table, and I think it's difficult to compare each one to the last one because they are so vastly different.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the statistics, the album that sold the most was Progress. Like, what?
She's one of my least favourite.
It's because of Robbie, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was one of my least favourite tours as well, was Progress, because of that fan rivalry that I was talking about, which was evident in the crowds as well.
And I don't like Progress because there's not a lot of Gary on there.
It's funny, isn't it?
It's a weird sound. It's a bit robotic, isn't it, really?
Yeah. But you see, you can't, and that's what I mean, you can't really compare Progress to Beautiful World. They're completely different albums. And you can't really compare Beautiful World to, say, Circus. Again, it's completely different. And so I think it's probably unfair to kind of say, yeah, it's a definitive album. I think it's probably a textbook comeback album. And I think if somebody in future years, if somebody is looking for the blueprint for a comeback album after a decade away, that's the album they should pick up. That's the album they should listen to. And that's where they should get their inspiration from.
It's an underrated album, though, to be fair.
It's an underrated tour as well. It's so underrated. It's not my favourite. It's not. I'm not going to say it is, but it was absolutely phenomenal. Unreal tour. And, you know, most of the songs are amazing, like Mark singing Hold On, like, come on.
Just, it's amazing.
Unreal, you know.
But do you think that maybe part of the reason it is underrated is because people have just forgotten about it? And if it's back on people's radar, in the same way that Take That played Circus on YouTube this weekend, if they were to put Beautiful World on and do a Beautiful World tweet-a-thon in the same way, it would be back on everyone's radar. And I think then we would see people talking about Beautiful World. I think people have just forgotten about it. They've moved on. The passage of time means that they're looking at more recent albums. And I think, I do genuinely think that that's the only issue with it. I don't think there's anything, I think fans still love it. And I think when, you know, when you think about where that's, those songs come from that you love, you kind of go, oh yeah, I'd forgotten about Beautiful World. And you know, and I just think that we do forget about it, you know, and I think we forget about its originality. After 10 years away, it must have been really hard and really challenging for them to come back with something that had so many new tunes on it. So,
oh yeah. I mean, I spoke to someone at the time who said they absolutely hated the original stuff, but they loved that because it was, you know, it was very modern. It had a different sound to it. You know, they weren't keen on that sort of 90s dance pop stuff, but obviously it was a lot more guitar focused. And certainly being there at the time, I found that maybe Rule the World kind of ruled it a little bit. After that song came out, it appeared that all the stuff that came previously was a little bit, you know, in the background.
I first heard Rule the World in Florida on the soundtrack to Stardust. It was one of the reasons we went to Stardust. My husband's a massive movie fan anyway, so we were always going to see it, but it was released over there long before it was released over here, and we were on holiday, so as you do, we went to see it. I made him sit right through the end credits. We're the only ones left in the auditorium. Everyone else had left, but, you know, it was worth it just to hear it. But I do think you are right. It's a phenomenal song. It's not a brilliant film, to be fair, but it is a phenomenal song. And I think it means a lot to so many people now. And I think that's the problem, that it's almost overshadowed the album. It's almost, I think you're right. I think it's kind of replaced the album in people's memories.
Mm. Yeah. I think Shine was better. Shine, definitely. Poor Mark, you know, all he had was Babe. That's all he had in the 90s. And then he comes with this amazing song, amazing video. Just so proud of him at that
moment. It was a great video. I enjoyed that. In fact, all the videos were very fitting, I think, for what they were, because Shine now is used in nearly every commercial, so it must have worked.
Shine on Great Day. You can't turn over without one of them, can you?
No. Oh, so God. Just sort of a last word thing here. Just name your favorite track off the album, or if you can't do that, your favorite three tracks.
Oh,
I know that's always hard. Everybody I've spoken to, that's always a hard thing. I'll go first. Probably for me, it'd be Wooden Boat. That's probably my favorite off that album.
Surprisingly, I'd Wait for Life is my favorite off that album, which is a very underrated song, to be fair.
I probably have two. I probably can't stretch to three, but I can probably stretch to two. And I probably say it's Wooden Boat and Hold On.
Yeah, I love Hold On. Probably Hold On, Beautiful World, and Ain't No Sense in Love. It's my singing in the shower song. And I love it. Yeah.
Well, there we are. That was Take That's Beautiful World. Thank you very much for coming on and talking Take That today. And we will do more of these, because upon putting the post out to the Take That fandom, they absolutely exploded. And to my knowledge, it's only happened maybe once before, where a fandom has grabbed onto something because you're all so enthusiastic about this subject. So I'd love to do more. So if you'd like to come on again, please do let me know. And of course, if anyone's listening out there that is a Take That fan that wants to come on and discuss either a tour or an album, even just a single song, it sounds like we could get even 10 minutes of conversation out of it. But thank you very much to Amy, Rachel, and Rachel for joining us today.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie.
And once again, I'd like to say thank you very much to the participants of that Take That roundtable. And if you're a fan and think you've missed out on the chance to participate, you haven't, we will be covering more areas of Take That's career in the near future. So keep an eye on social media for future opportunities. Now, once again, it's the return of our The Empty Compartment feature on the show. Now, before we get to it, let me ask our guest, which is once again the returning guest, David Snape, radio presenter extraordinaire. What is your favourite Take That song?
That is going to be a really, really hard one. I think in terms of earlier hits, I don't know, but something like Sure would kind of stands out for me at the moment. It kind of is, I got that in my head really at the moment. I think as a favourite, it might have to be something like The Flood when Robbie Williams Astley was back, you know, in the Take That lineup as a five. Possibly, yeah, I would probably go for The Flood, really.
And I think many fans would agree with you and be surprised by Sure as something to be chosen there. But thank you for sharing that, David. So it's once more time to take a step into the empty compartment. And thank you very much for joining us today, radio presenter David Snape. And just in case people didn't catch the last time that you were on, tell us about your show.
So basically, my radio show is I'm presenting it with an excellent co-host called Christina Groombridge. It's a local radio show for my area, which is kind of Lincolnshire and parts of Cambridgeshire and Rutland, and this putting in you know what is brilliant about our local area. We usually chat about you know how our week is going and just do many amazing interviews with all sorts of fascinating people. Really enjoying doing it, including my lockdown diaries. At this time of recording, I'm up to around 42, 43 entries at the moment. So I say it's something for everybody, this radio show.
Well, it's fantastic. And once again, thank you for joining us today. And people can go and check out David Snape's radio show on Mixcloud as well. So this is the empty compartment. Three questions and myself joined by a guest, which today is David Snape. Firstly, I ask a question. Then David asks a question. Then we have a listener question. And these are questions based around 90s and noughties pop culture. And I'll be honest with you, the more random, the better, so that we can stir up debate and that sort of thing. And last time David was on, I turned the format on its head at first by making him ask the question first. And guess what, David? I'm going to do it again. What's your question?
Okay, right. So video games did shoot up from the mid 90s into the noughties, and quite a lot of the stuff has been to do with you know, sort of platforming games, some really, really, really brilliant characters that, you know, carries on even to this day. So, I mean, in terms of like platform games and characters, do you prefer Crash Bandicoot, Spyro the Dragon, or something else?
Back in the day, they were two Sony mascots, basically, Crash and Spyro. And out of those two, definitely Crash. I find Spyro annoying. I love Spyro, but Spyro is very much looking round, looking for things, loads of time wasted. Whereas Crash is, well, I know it's very linear in its very nature, and I suppose in some cases you are just keep trying again because it's so hard. So yeah, I'd probably say Crash out of those two.
Okay, I think for me the most interest, the only interesting thing about the Spiral one, except for they, you know, being quite cute, was I think I remember being younger, and there was a mode where he was on a skateboard. So it was kind of a bit like a Tony Hawk kind of, you know, kind of thing, because that was another one of those games that I think that was kind of out, kind of like in the same, you know, sort of era. I mean, a small dragon riding a skateboard, and that is kind of, it's kind of weird to say the least, but
it's so cool.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, doing the backflip and all of that. I think that's, you know, really, really good. But I do agree with you on the Crash Bandicoot kind of the side of things, which does make me have a little bit of a memory for, because one of the things on the PlayStation 4, I think they kind of like combined some of the older Crash Bandicoot games all into one. So, and I promised my girlfriend Ellie is if that little bundle comes, you know, at a reasonable price, I will buy the game. And we will make sure, you know, we will complete the levels together without being blown up by TNT.
Well, I tell you what, those remastered games are fantastic. I own a copy. It's very, very good. And certainly the games looked okay anyway. They looked okay anyway. They still stand up pretty well, those original graphics. And I think even Spyro to a much lesser extent. But the remastered versions of those games are extremely good, and much harder than I remember them being. But then I think it was always pretty difficult. And I think I must have just given up too early.
Oh, okay. I mean, they also try and do like other stuff, like did Crash did like a team racing thing, a kind of like a Sonic, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog type of, you know, bumper to bumper racing and that.
You mean Mario Kart?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah. I am noticing a slight. Because normally when you mention platformers, you mention Mario, and we haven't mentioned Mario until this moment. What have you got against Mario?
I don't actually play Mario that much, but I can remember having a go on them on I think it was a Game Boy, I think it was. Like you know, going through all sorts of, you know, all sorts of different levels. But now with Mario, you can like create your own levels and that.
Which is a fantastic idea for people like me that grew up as a Nintendo kid. So would you call yourself a Sony kid?
Just because my first console that I've ever bought on love was a PlayStation. Yes, it will probably have to be that.
That explains the lack of Mario in our conversation. And thank you for clearing that up. So let's move on to the second question here, which comes from me. So let me ask you, David, and again, it's a food question. I must be hungry. That's all I can say. I must be hungry, because the only questions I can ever think about, because I always think my guests are going to come up with things about gaming or TV or music. So I try and be different. And all I can think about is food. So the last time you were on, I asked about something food related. So this time, the Kellogg's Variety Pack. Okay, so the Kellogg's Variety Pack, a staple of breakfast time in the 90s and noughties in some cases. I think it's still a thing. Do you eat the cornflakes or do you just give them to somebody else?
Oh, wow. I mean, I definitely have the cornflakes, even now. A bit of a funny thing. So these smaller packs of the Kellogg's ranges. I mean, because I can remember, I think in Southfields Primary School, and this has just come to me, I think they did like a breakfast club. And one of the things that I remember is having these kind of small, I don't know if they're like packs of six or eight, but I think you've got like cornflakes, you've got Cocoa Pops and Frosties and all of that. I mean, I'm still kind of eating Cocoa Pops for breakfast now at the moment, but it's only because Ellie bought a big pack and she felt like, having cornflakes didn't suit her. So she would probably needed a bit more variety. So I'm currently at the moment, demolishing the rest of that earth.
See, I'm surprised that you liked cornflakes, because most people would go, well, cornflakes is the boring one in that selection.
Well, I mean, I think back when I was younger, I would probably go for the Frosties and sort of that. But I mean, I'm starting in my 30s now, and I would say even if it's a supermarket brand of a certain cereal, I mean, I could have Weetabix another day, or maybe like an Alpen or a Brian Flakes or something or something like that. But I definitely don't mind a bit of cornflakes. So I don't know what is wrong with people if they don't like cornflakes.
Well, there we go. That's David's last stand on that. I don't know what's wrong with people if they don't like cornflakes. We love cornflakes, David. It's just that when placed with the choice of that or Cocoa Pops or Frosties, I think most people would go for those.
Of course, and they are definitely the more exciting ones. But I don't mind having cornflakes if they were one of the last ones in the pack.
Ah, so now you've changed. Now it's become, oh, if it was the last one there, I'd eat it, yeah. So it was not the first one you'd go for.
I would probably go for Frosties just because I haven't had Frosties for years. And I would love to see how that tastes like again.
Well, if the adverts were anything to go by, they were great. So that's the second question. Let's bring that to a close, shall we? And let's go on to our third question, which is always a listener question. And once again, you haven't disappointed me. Thank you to Tom for getting to us and asking us a question in particular. Back in the day, people used to listen to their music on either tape or CD. What was your preference? That's what they ask. So back in the day, people listened to music on tape or CD. It doesn't mention whether that's out and about or just indoors. So I'm going to take it as a little bit of both. And I'm going to put the question to David.
My preferred option would be to, because I was kind of like one of those ones that recorded stuff from the CD onto a tape, so that I can have kind of like a mixtape for myself, and I would use the tape to listen to some of the songs on there. Because I think, to be honest, I think in terms of CDs and that, you don't I mean, it's the same with albums nowadays. I mean, you have songs that you like more than others, and I used to really, really love to to create my own mixtapes on that, and that would probably be my preferred option.
Yeah, and I think we were still doing that in the 90s. It's very much seen as sort of an 80s thing to make mixtapes, but we were still doing that. And I know I had I remember the first time I got a Walkman, like a CD Walkman, and it had like Anti-Skip or something on it, didn't it? And it was rubbish, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think what says it really. So the iPod Classic. Now I didn't have that at the time. I think a few years later, it was kind of like one of those small mini ones, and it was probably one of the things that I regretted not having, because it does look the bomb. It does look so cool. In the way that it was and that and for me that kind of says how we listen to music beyond like the CDs and tapes.
Oh, definitely, because to tapes you had a certain amount of freedom, because you could put, certainly for blank cassettes, you could put the music that you wanted to listen to on them in your order, but it was only sort of a certain amount. You had, say, 60 to 90 minutes per cassette, compared to hundreds upon thousands of hours for an iPod. CDs, I mean, we used to buy loads of CDs back in the day. I didn't buy many singles. I always thought the single was a tad redundant by the time we got to sort of the late 90s on CD, because you'd buy a CD with a couple of tracks on it, and it would seem a bit wasteful in some way.
Yeah, of course, and I know what you mean. But I read something about tapes recently, because a bit like the old vinyl, tapes are starting to go back into fashion. And they were saying something about so Lady Gaga's new album, they got it onto tape and they put that in three tapes, and they are all like colourful sort of masterpieces and that, by just by the look of it. And I just there thinking to myself, why didn't they do that back in the day? It would just look like that. Maybe you would think that the tape would probably overtake the CD just by looking a bit funky.
Yeah, but it's style over substance, isn't it?
That's kind of true on that. But it'd be interesting to see how you know if the tape cassette will still grow in the years to come, because I think it'll be sorry to, you know, just make it all completely redundant in a few years.
Yeah, but tapes were a bit rubbish at times. I mean, yeah, you had the portability of it and you had the ability to tape stuff onto it. So there was that freedom there. But I don't know whether you ever had that weird experience where you'd tape something, you'd go out on a car trip and the battery would be running low and it would slow down into nothing, you know, and it's like, this is such a weird experience. And it almost felt like a waste of a battery, because it's like, it's running down. How can I listen to it when it's half the speed of what it, you know, like, it was weird. It's a weird experience.
Yeah, and I think you do get that with, you know, tapes, you know, throughout the time that the things around inside can go all mumbo jumbo and all of that. It's a bit kind of similar to old BASS ones, if they started to to go all floppy and that as well. But that was the beauty of it back in the day as well. So, yeah, I just love it.
It's what we had then, and it was top of the range in the most part.
Yeah, exactly. Because there is a 90s podcast called Sounds of the 90s with Fern Conlon, and she mentioned about BASS and that. And even having some films, you know, blockbusters, we'd be like a weekly membership and that, just picking which films that you want to rent for a certain number of days, then you bring it back. as well.
I mean, those were the days when you were able to do that, and it carried on very much from the 1980s when that became very much commonplace. Now, there we are. We've come to the end of this segment of The Empty Compartment, but thank you once again, David, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much once again to David Snape and all of our participants in today's podcast for giving up their time in order to contribute to the show. And that's exactly what I think of it as. I think of it as a show, a combination of different things, including that, and of course the round tables and post bag, and a new feature that I would like to implement that I've been thinking about for some time, and I'm not quite sure how it's going to work yet, but I'm going to take some time out of this podcast just to introduce it to you so that you can tell me whether it's a good idea or not. Okay, so here it goes. I would like to introduce something just to put on the end of the podcast, but in no way is like just using up time. I want something a little bit more worthy. I want something people can participate in, and I want something that is fun and engaging. And I thought, well, what's more engaging than a quiz? There's probably loads of things, but basically it's a quiz. I'd like to introduce a little quick quiz at the end of the podcast. So if anybody is interested in participating in a pop culture themed quiz at the end of the podcast, I haven't quite come up with the name of it yet, but I will do at some point, then please do get in contact with us. And I can tell you it won't be very long. The actual quiz element of it will only be about 90 seconds, hence the working title of Quick Quiz. So yeah, only about 90 seconds long for that, which is just enough time, I think, at the end, just to have a little quick, oh, yeah, that one, that question. So yeah, if you're interested, do let me know. And if anybody wants to help me come up with questions and stuff, you'll be exempt from participating, but you know, you can become a part of the podcast, because again, this isn't just my podcast, it's also yours, you know. It's something that I want people to participate in many different ways. So if anybody wants to help me with that, please do let me know. And if you're completely against the idea of a quiz at the end, or you think that the whole podcast should just be one thing and one thing only, then please do get in contact. Yes, I am saying get in contact and let me know, because once again, if you don't want a quiz, if you don't want something fun at the end of the podcast, then who am I to force it on you? Tell me. Complain. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hopefully implementing that. I'm not sure whether it will be podcasters or whether it will be just members of the public that kind of call in and do 90 seconds. And again, it all depends, actually. That might change over time. The amount of time given might change. Who knows? I'm not quite sure how a scoring system would work. I think there should be a scoring system for different participants. And I should say that there wouldn't be any prize. There's no cash or physical prizes on offer, or any prize for that matter. It would just be for fun. Just for fun. Because that's this whole podcast. Just for fun. So yeah, well, I'm going to draw this podcast to a close now, but before I do, I will say that on next week's podcast, I'm going to be introducing two roundtables based around the subject of A1's album Make It Good. Now, it's something we've not done before, because the first roundtable will be with fans based in Southeast Asia, and the second roundtable will be UK-based fans. So that'll be something to look forward to on the next edition of the podcast. And I'm not quite sure what else is there yet, because it all depends how the edit goes. Wish me luck with that. Right. Now it's time to say goodbye, but thank you very much for listening to the 90s and Noughties UK podcast, a podcast on UK pop culture from the 90s and 2000s. This is Jamie Dyer saying, once again, if you'd like to get in contact, please do. You can email 90sandnoughties@gmail.com. You can tweet us at 90snoughties UK on Twitter, or you can go to the Facebook page, which is just simply 90s and Noughties UK. That's what you need to do to get in contact with us. From me, Jamie Dyer, bye-bye for now.